Welcome to Coin Flips and Controversies, an OrthoBullets original series dedicated to exploring gray zone decisions in orthopedic surgery.
Yeah, I am Anas Malkawi from Germany. I work in Nittetal. I'm a consultant orthopedic surgeon and shoulder surgeon from Germany. I am happy today to introduce my experts. I am delighted to introduce Professor Joseph Aput from United States of America, a globally renowned shoulder surgeon. Dr. Aput has emerged as a distinguished surgeon and educator, contributing significantly to the field of education. And he is working in the Ruthman Institute. I'm pleased also to introduce my dear friend, Dr. Abdallah Zelmi from Northern Germany. I did my residency program with him. Today's discussion, our focus will center around the humeral head fractures and proximal humeral fractures, emphasizing the importance of their management strategy. Our primary concentration will be developing a systematic approach for decision making in the assessment and treatment of these fractures by culminating of this webinar. Our goals is to craft a practical algorithm that serves as a guiding framework, aiding orthopedic surgeons in effectively addressing the complexity presented by these cases. So I am happy to introduce my colleagues and experts. Please, you are Joseph and Abdallah.
Thanks, Anas. Thanks for the kind introduction. Thanks for putting this case together. It's nice to virtually meet both of you. We've never met in person, but this is the great thing sometimes about the virtual world. We get to go transatlantic and have different perspectives. So I'm looking forward to your perspectives, Abdallah and Anas, on this case, and look forward to learning from you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you so much. So, Abdallah.
Thanks, Anas. For me, also this, we are like every 2-3 weeks, we're in contact with different cases. Also on the personal level, we have a lot to do together. But I think it's great that we have this opportunity to get into contact with others so we can discuss issues and discuss the different opinions, what we in person, like two of us discussing with other people like Dr. Aboud or Dr. Tanner, if you'll join us. So this is great that we learn also from others.
So my point I would make, Abdallah, is we'll edit this out. When you're moving your hand, it's going in front of your camera.
Oh yeah, okay.
So just be careful that maybe move your camera a little bit. So if you're using your hands, doesn't face.
Great.
Okay, so let us start now with our case. So our case is a 49-year-old female sought a medical attention due to severe pain, swelling, and limitation of mobility in her left shoulder following a traumatic incident where she fell down the stairs. On the physical examination, the patient exhibited visible swelling over the left shoulder with ecchymosis evident in the surrounding areas. The patient expressed severe pain when attempting any movement of the left shoulder joint. Active range of motion was limited in all planes, and passive manipulation was met with resistance and discomfort. Her neurovascular exam of the left upper extremity is normal. So, Dr. Aput, during the physical examination, what are the important signs and findings with the humeral head fractures, and how can we effectively assess the neurological status in these cases?
Yeah, so, this is a fairly high energy fall. It's a young person, 49. I think making sure that we're looking at the ABCs first before we dive into the shoulder, make sure she didn't have any associated head trauma, no pulmonary injuries, rib fractures, pneumothoraces, and then assessing the actual extremity itself, looking for deformity, ecchymosis, skin integrity. And then, you know, typically my neurovascular examination here is a lot of times people are very resistant to any active range of motion of the proximal shoulder girdle. You can sometimes get them to fire their deltoid a little bit to assess their axillary nerve to make sure there's continuity. Sensation is not super reliable with the axillary nerve. And I'll do a simple examination of the elbow, wrist, and hand, make sure they have elbow flexion, extension, radial musculocutaneous, ulnar median nerves, check their distal pulses, make sure that they're okay. But, you know, obviously also getting a sense of their baseline level of function with their arm before the injury. Did they have any problems? Was this a pristine shoulder? Was this a shoulder that they were seeking treatment for other reasons for? Was there any known pre-existing pathology, which will affect kind of my treatment algorithm? And then what's her underlying comorbidities? You know, is she diabetic? Is she obese? She have any other issues that I have to worry about in addition to this high energy injury?
Yes. Abdallah, what do you mean? What you are looking for?
Basically, he said all of it. I can only confirm the issue about thoracic injuries. We had like 3 or 4 years ago a case, and intraoperatively, it turned out to be a series of rib fractures with the pneumothorax and hematothorax, which was through the anesthesia and the intubation, a very life-threatening condition, and it was we didn't find about it in the initial clinical examination. We found about it intraoperatively, which was a disaster. And she was like 3 days in the station, and we discovered it intraoperatively. It was not that huge pneumothorax, but it got worse through the anesthesia.
Yes, it's
that's why it's very important to address the other injuries, especially the thoracic injuries.
Yeah, as Dr. Abud said, now ABC is an important issue to consider. So after this, we have done an X-ray. This is the X-ray view, the anterior-posterior view of the left shoulder. My question now, what specific findings are crucial and what elements you are seeking in X-ray when assessing patients with this kind of fractures? Which X-ray views are considered relevant in your assessment and clinical practice? Joseph.
If I saw this X-ray, then obviously very concerning fracture dislocation, discontinuity of the anatomic head and the axillary recess, and disruption of the greater tuberosity into the surgical neck. So a very concerning fracture pattern for a young person for a variety of things, including neurovascular injury, disvascularization to the head. So this is a patient that I typically will not do my full series of X-rays. I'll have them do a CT scan because I don't want to manipulate the arm too much for a variety of reasons, including risking neurovascular injury and or tremendous pain for the patient.
So the CT scan is considered as a mandatory in such cases. So what are you looking for in computer tomography? Do you use it to address the complexity of these fractures, the fragments, importantly also to plan your surgery?
So, based on just the X-ray, I'm already, given her age, I'm already very concerned about the options for treatment. This is first of all not a fracture that I would treat conservatively in a patient that is in her age group with her functional status. So this is an operative fracture from the get-go. Now I'm trying to put together, what is my decision process on how to treat this operative fracture, given the the displacement of the head, the anatomic neck fracture, associated comminution. I have concern about the vascularity of the head in the postoperative period. And fixing this is actually quite tricky, as well as getting the neck shaft angle right. In addition, I want to look at the glenoid, make sure I'm not missing any kind of glenoid fracture or rim fractures that could support the patient having long-term recurrent instability despite operative ORIF, if you chose ORIF, or other options. So a lot of information is gleaned from just the x-ray, but, you know, also I think the detail of the CT, and then, you know, the pulses distally, and then there's also a concern about, you know, arterial injury and potentially considering an arteriogram CT angio, just make sure there's no compromise of the axillary.
Yes, it is. Yes, Abdallah, what's your opinion about this? Dr. Aboud if there is a potential nerve or blood vessel injury, he exactly. will also need a CT angiography. Do you rely solely on the clinical examination to assess the neurovascular status of the patient, or do you find it is necessary and mandatory to do a CT angiography in this in these situations?
So apart from this case, I actually recommend with every proximal humerus fracture that we have a CT to address every single detail of the fracture. At the beginning of my residence program, we didn't do that. Then, like 3 years later, our head of department just started this, and I think it is not that bad idea that we recommend a CT examination for every single proximal humerus fracture. Nevertheless, when the patients are in that age group, I know it's you have two teams now. Team A, a lot of CT, a lot of X-ray, and they're young age. And the other team says, "Yeah, we have to know everything about the fracture because before going through the planning for the therapy." But I'm still for the second team that we have to have a CT before the operation. Secondly, whether it's with an angiography or not, I'd rather do a CT angiography when I have clinical findings that says, yeah, it may be injured. Otherwise, I won't do any CT angiography.
And it's also a little bit different if, you know, let's say the patient presents acutely and there's no distal concern for compromise vascularly. Now, if the patient presents 2 weeks, 3 weeks later, and they start forming some callus, then there's concern that the vessel could be entangled in that. And you should know that, because as you disrupt that callus, you may avulse a branch of the artery or avulse the artery. So that always concerns me, especially in delayed treatment.
Okay.
To sort of think about. The other thing is, obviously, you have some patients who have some calcification of vessels if they're older and they have cardiovascular disease. So, you know, I think that obviously that comes into consideration for this as well. Mm. The one last thing I didn't mention about CT scan, which is helpful in some patients that you have a high suspicion for cuff pathology, is looking at the muscle bellies and to assess, you know, what the integrity of their pre-existing was.
Yes. So after considering the patient's history, physical examination, and the relevant investigations, including these this radiological findings, I think obtaining a classification of these fractures is essential for effective communication with other orthopedic surgeons and also in planning our treatment. So, Joseph, what classification system do you utilize in describing these fractures for both communication with other orthopedic surgeons and for you to guide your treatment strategy? Do you have personally a classification system? Do you use your expert, your experience with this, or you rely on NIR classification, AU classification? So what's your opinion?
Yeah, I mean, I think that classification systems, as you discussed, allow us to communicate verbally what's going on with the patient visually. I think in the world today where image transmission is so quick, I think it's probably a little bit more of a historical footnote as far as classifications go, as far as communicating. I think obviously certain levels of fractures have different types of potential for difficulties with outcome and complications. And when you're writing a paper, it's nice to sort of classify them because you can't put an image of every single fracture. For that fracture, you know, it's a fracture dislocation, four-part fracture. And, you know, I use the NIR classification predominantly. I think the AO and Ralph Hurdle's classification are also nice to kind of be a little bit more detailed. But I think if you look at penetration of which classification really is used the most in common terminology, it's the NIR classification. But, you know, just to kind of, you know, put a little social spin on it. Here in the States, Curb Your Enthusiasm is a very common and well liked show. And there's an actor named Larry David, and he has the old sort of not so bad and that's pretty bad. You know, and this is one where I look at this and I go, this is pretty bad. You know, this one when I'm walking by the screen in my clinic, I look at it and I stop and I go, who's that? Versus sometimes you walk by a fracture and you go, okay, ho-hum, pretty simple. You know, this is definitely one where, unfortunately, I think this is a series of potential, even if things go great, operations for this patient over their lifetime with this arm. It'd be pretty uncommon. It's be a 49-year-old, a one and done, unless you choose a certain pathway, which I don't want to bias people towards, but I think this is a long-term issue for this patient moving forward.
Yes, I think it is very important to have a classification system which guide us to treat these patients. I think the NIR classification is not so sufficient to take such decisions. Do you agree with this, or what are your thoughts about these classification systems? In other words. Yeah, you told me now about this classification and how it is in the United States. For us in Germany, for example, we are looking for the angulation, the dislocation on the displacement of the fracture. We are looking for tubercle injury if it is dislocated more as 3 millimeter. Or 2 millimeter. So it is very important to describe the morphology of these fractures, because it's important to decide which therapy option will we choose, conservative or operative, and if operative, what type of operation we have to execute in these cases.
I agree with you. I mean, you know, if you think about it, historically when these classifications came to be, we were still dealing primarily with one-dimensional images. You know, I think it should be standard of care that we're getting CT scans, 3D reconstructions, as now we have three-dimensional reconstructions of these images. So a lot of times these classifications are not adequate to get the nuances that you're talking about as far as, you know, angulation, displacement, involvement of tuberosity, cuff integrity, all those types of things. So, again, I would say classically, I'm not somebody that will, stick straight to just a classification system in my decision-making. I think that as all of us gain experience with these fracture patterns, again, this is a high probability given the displacement, anatomic neck fracture of vascular compromise, AVN, with any type of RAF, It's difficult with hemiarthroplasty to reconstruct the two varices and have them heal and get good function. And then reverse is controversial in this age group. Obviously with ORAF, there's various ways of approaching ORAF in these types of cases as well. So I think from a classical education perspective, classification systems are helpful to understand and know, so you can speak a language, and transatlantically speak a language. But I think, you know, you show me that image, it tells me a lot more than just if you told me it was an AO type, whatever, or a hurdle type, etc.
Yeah. So Abdullah, what do you think about classification system?
So
Abdullah, I'm going to interrupt you. I totally forgot to do something in the beginning. Can you turn your cam background on blur? On Zoom, there's a setting to change your background settings. If you see where it says your video camera, there's a little upgoing arrow to the right of it.
Siri says stop video. There's an arrow that goes up.
It says blur my background.
Yeah, just a second. So
it's not a big deal if you can't do it. Are you on your phone?
Yeah, on my iPad.
Yeah, there should be a place to blur my background.
Yeah, I'm just looking for it because it's in German.
Can you see the video?
Yeah, see?
It
should be by your video settings.
Yeah, blur my background.
Is it blurred now?
Not now.
Just a second.
If you can't find it in 10 seconds, we'll skip it and it's fine as is.
I can't find it. Sorry.
I'd skip it. So Anas, why don't you just start again and ask him about you were asking about the classification system. So just restate the question to him so we can, edit out this part.
Okay. So, Abdullah, now, do you rely on a classification system for the management of these fractures, or do you rely on your experience?
So concerning classification system, I'm not a fan of classifications. Sorry to say that, but it's a lot of work and a lot of studies. But I actually, when you face the reality, the classification, it will help you to communicate with others, verbal communication or whatever, but actually it will not help you to take a decision whether now an arthroplasty or hemiarthroplasty or IF or conservative, what to do. What I'm a fan of is the management algorithm to have through this classification. Well, yeah. Classification is good, but what foreign clinical impact does this classification have is the most important thing. So when 2011, there was an algorithm from the medical school of Hanover. I think it's kind of simple, but it's very effective concerning the proximal humerus fracture, where they said below 60, not dislocated, so conservative, dislocated, operative or conservative, depending on how dislocated it is, more than 1 centimeter, so it's operative, less than 1 centimeter, so it's conservative. So I mean through this algorithm, I can take a decision whether to treat this patient conservative or operative, or whether to address the patient himself into the decision. Sorry?
Are you saying dislocation or displacement?
Yeah. Displacement. Sorry for the... because in German, it is dislocation.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
Patients were over 60 years old, so they're treating them like conservative, whether they have displacement or not, even if there's more than 1 centimeter. So it's through this algorithm, you can achieve the goal of treatment, whether it's conservative or operative, but having a verbal communication or having a classification that does not have a clinical impact on your decision. I mean, I can remember the same question I asked my senior consultant at the beginning of my residence program, what classification are you using? Then he answered me. He had a very good sense of humor. He answered me, I know only one classification. This fracture I can manage when I see the x-ray, but when it is very complicated, so it's a very complicated fracture on another x-ray, I have to run away. I don't know how to manage it. This is the classification I know. So having a classification with explaining how the fracture look like and in which direction it is dislocated or displaced, it does not help me that much to achieve my goal.
Yes.
Another algorithm which I really like and I use actually in my clinical practice is from Switzerland, Dr. Sposs. His name is Sposs, and he's the chief department of the traumatology and orthopedics in Zurich. It's a little bit more complicated, this algorithm, but it is very well addressed for many details, whether the patient is osteoporotic or not, how many fracture parts, is it stable or not, is there reconstruction possible or not. And then through going through this algorithm, you can achieve your goal and just take the right decision for the patient. And I think this algorithm from Dr. Sposs is very good.
Thank you. So now, we have discussed the classification system, history, radiographical findings. Now we are considering the treatment option of fractures. So the therapy options, we have the conservative option and operative option. I think in this case, it is more likely that we decide for operative treatment. Joseph, when considering a conservative treatment of proximal humeral fracture, what criteria guide you in decision making? Do you prioritize patient age or do you assess fracture morphology, degree of comminution, displacement, angulation? What involve your decision in such cases?
Sure. I always tell patients, most of what I do is lifestyle management, not life saving. So even a fracture, even a displaced fracture dislocation, is still lifestyle management at some level. It's not life threatening per se, unless there's a vascular injury or it's an open injury. So, you know, there are multiple factors that I think we all need to consider when treating a patient: age, health, activity level, hand dominance, severity of the injury, whether you're using a classification or visual cues as the fracture goes, profession, hobbies, short-term and long-term goals, philosophy, and social support. All those factors come into play in helping them make a decision that's right for them. So, you know, it's very much a shared decision process. There's a lot you need to, you know, I always tell patients, a fracture is much harder than patients who have progressive arthritis, because yesterday you were fine, today you're not. Now you have potentially a severe injury. You're meeting people you've never met before. You didn't always necessarily choose those people. Sometimes they're thrust upon you because you happen to be at a hospital with a certain traumatologist or shoulder specialist. And now you're making life altering decisions that affect the next 30, 40 years of your life in a matter of hours or days. And so I think it's very important to take your time and talk to them about the real risks here, that, you know, there is a complication rate, there is an outcome issue, there is the expectation, which may not be realistic, of full functional recovery, whether it's with conservative management or surgical management. And all those things are important to have on the front end. I think as you get older as a surgeon, it's easier to have those conversations early on when you're younger. There they're nerve-wracking for you as the provider sometimes, and also for the patient for sure. And sometimes we tend to, from empathy reasons, maybe gloss over some of the nuances of treatment or some of the complications to help put them at ease a little bit. But I don't think that's necessarily a good thing, because they'll come back sometimes and say, I didn't realize I was going to have 70% function. I didn't realize I was going to have impingement from the plate. I didn't realize I was going to have decreased rotation of my arm. I didn't realize I could have a nerve injury. All these things that happen in the process of treating fractures, that, you know, it's definitely a 30 to 45 minute conversation at the very least for the patient to make a decision that they're comfortable with.
So can you provide us from your experience, which is a relevant radiological findings in the X-ray and computer tomography that help you to determine the likelihood of success of a conservative treatment for cases with proximal humeral fracture?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously with less involvement of pieces, fragments, less displacement, valgus is usually better tolerated, less involvement of comminution of the articular surface. Definitely making sure you pay attention, particularly to the greater tuberosity and where it is relative to the head. Is it close or is it rotating around the back posteriorly and superiorly? Those are bad players, right? When you have a fracture dislocation, when the tuberosity is going around the back and superiorly, those patients will get pseudoparalytic fairly quickly. And those are patients, in my experience, if they're healthy enough and functional enough, that should have some fixation of that tuberosity. So, I'm looking at the glenoid, right? Because if it's a proximal humerus fracture, it's not uncommon that you have some glenoid involvement that you'd be aware of, because that can affect, again, the progression of stability, arthritic changes, et cetera. And while those can be managed conservatively still, and you try to give them a sense of where they're going to be at 6 months with non-operative management, based on an average, based on your experience, your treatment of patients, and obviously listening to your colleagues and professionals like in such settings as this to get more educated. And I think giving them a rough sense of what they're going to have, because some people may not really care that they can't get their hand up to their hair again or potentially have a light toss. Others are going to be dramatically affected if they can't do those things. And I think the more displacement you have, the more articular involvement you have, the higher likelihood those limitations will be significant and permanent. And either you address them now or you consider addressing them later, depending on the patient preference. But you know, all those things come into play for me as far as how to make a decision.
So, Abdallah, considering the conservative therapy of such fractures, do you communicate with your patient? How do you counsel your patients to decide your treatment? Some patients say, They want to go for a high activity level many years later. But so it's important to counsel these patients. How do you approach these patients?
The age play a very important role, the age of the patient, but it's not only the age, it's the age plus the activity of the patient, because I can have a young patient, he's like 50 years old, but he's an alcoholic, or he's a heavy smoker, or both. So actually, only addressing the age, it's not, it's important, but you have to address other social factors with the age. You have to treat the patient as a whole. You can't take just the fracture and say, this fracture, I'm going to treat it or IF or with a prosthesis. No, it's a whole entity. So you have to look at the age of the patient. You have to look at his social behavior, his whether he's comorbid or not. And then start, as I said, through the algorithm. Yeah. So if you have a young and active patient with eventually or with probably good bone quality, and you have one part fracture, so you have to ask yourself, is this fracture more than 5 millimeter displaced or less than? If it is, so you have to go for ORIF. If it's not, so it's a conservative. if you have more than one part fracture, 2, 3, or 4, you have to start asking yourself, if it is valgus impacted or not. If it is valgus impacted, so you have to go for a plate. If it is not, so it's like stable and anatomical reconstruction possible. So you have to ask yourself once more, yeah, it is stable and it's anatomically reconstructible. So you go for a plate. If not, it's a prosthesis. If you have an elderly patient, so here starts the dilemma of whether I go for the chance and give him the chance to have a plate and you have your fracture once more addressed, and probably he can skip the complications of avascular necrosis and etc. Or I just take the decision from the beginning and say, no, we go through a prosthesis. These situations, I have to pull the patient himself through the decision process to be as a part of the process, not to just let him a passive part of the process. I just start asking questions and just dragging him into the decision-making process, that he starts to think with me, what does he want?
Yeah.
I start giving him the information, because he's not he's a layperson. He doesn't know anything about his fracture, doesn't know anything about taking a decision in this situation. So I start feeding him with the information, and I start telling him, yeah, you have this and that, and what do you want? So yep. It is a decision that we take together.
Okay.
In my opinion, decisions with younger patients, it's easier than decision to be taken in patients like 65 and older.
Yes.
So, because, you know, you can never estimate how active they are.
Yes. So now we are choosing the operative management for such a patient. Considering the displacement and the tuberosity, if dislocated posteriorly or superiorly. If we have a young patient and we are opting for open reduction and internal fixation to treat these dislocation fractures, what are the factors do you consider for a crucial and a successful procedure and focus to minimize the risk of vascular necrosis of the humeral head? Could you share your experience with us, Joseph? That's what is the consideration you take, or you look in the X-ray and you say there is a high probability of a vascular necrosis?
Yeah, so I mean, in general, not the specific fracture, but in general, when if I decide that it's an operative fracture and I'm taking it to the OR, barring a significant articular involvement like this one with dislocation of the head, I think a lot of patients do not go on to develop avascular necrosis. So my typical approach to this is, I just to kind of take you through the steps real quick. This is a slightly inclined 30 degrees beach chair type position for me, fluoro from the contralateral side. It's a delta pectoral approach. First thing I do is identify my biceps, tenotomize it, and tenodesis it to the pec, identify my bicipital groove, identify my tuberosities, tag my tuberosities with multiple sutures that are on the lesser tuberosity, the greater tuberosity. So typically 2 on the subscap, 2 on the supra infra, and 2 sutures on the teres infra region. And then a lot of times these patients get to me at a time where there's had some callus formation. So disimpacting the fracture is important, not going crazy to create a complete instability and maybe disrupting any area of the calcar or blood supplies coming in, but definitely disrupting it enough so I can reduce the fracture in an anatomic fashion while directly visualizing it and also using my fluoroscopy. And if I'm fixing a fracture, for me, most of the time, it's using a plate fixation. I'm not somebody who uses much in the form of intramedullary nails or just suture fixation, et cetera, like a parachute technique. So, you know, plating lateral to the bicipital groove, making sure I have enough fixation distally to get a stable construct, placing my screws, using a system that can place the plate low enough so I don't get acromial impingement with abduction, and then a wide array of screws that fan out into the head, making sure that the screws are well short of the articular surface. So if there is any collapse, the fracture, the screws don't penetrate into the joint. And then it's very important at the end of the case to reinforce your fixation by passing your sutures that you've passed through the plate to augment your repair. Because I really, most of these patients, especially if they're osteoporotic, more fractures than high energy fractures, their bone quality is very poor. And you're really relying on that tendon bone interface to really provide extra fixation to the plate so early healing can happen. So those are kind of my, I would say, major pearls for fixation of these fractures. Then they're in a sling, typically 7 to 10 days, and then I start them in motion.
What kind of sutures do you use to address the supraspinatus, infraspinatus, fiber wire?
So one of my senior partners, John Fenland, taught me to use 1 millimeter cotton dacrons, non-absorbable braided suture, which is double loaded with needles and very strong suture. So I've always used that, but yeah, I think you could use other strong non-resorbable suture.
I use fiber wire from Arthrex.
Mm-hmm.
Do you mean by two sutures, you mean with the same thread you make double suturing or two separate?
No, I typically throw two separate sutures. Each one of them is usually a figure. For me, it's a figure eight suture. So I throw
for me too.
Totals of six sutures. Like I said, up front, two up top, two in the back.
Mm. And do you move them or you place them through the plate too, the holes on the plate?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah,
that's critical. Okay. I think it's absolutely critical if you pass those sutures at the end of the case or when you're placing your plate. People, some people like to place it when you're placing your plate. Some people like to place it at the end once they place all their screws. But you definitely want to use it as augmented fixation.
No.
So, is the timing of the surgery have an impact on the outcomes? What are the key considerations aimed at reducing the risk of the vascular necrosis if you are doing open reduction and internal fixation? So, yeah, Joseph.
So, you know, optimally, if I can get to these in a week, that's great. You know, the benefit of being older sometimes is you're not seeing as much hot trauma. You're seeing what we call cold trauma here in the U.S. And so, you know, those patients are coming in at 10 to 14 days. By the time, a lot of times they have other medical issues, they get their medical clearance. You're sometimes close to 2.5, 3 weeks. It's not ideal, but it's still doable. Once you get into the 4 to 6 week range, you start really worrying about how much callus you're taking down. You know, how much harder is the reduction going to be? Because now you've got some fibrosis in the tissue. You've got some muscle memory developing and it's more difficult, still doable, but more difficult. Beyond 6 weeks, you really start worrying about, you know, are you going to be able to get the fracture really anatomically reduced? Or are you going to really have to do a fracture takedown, which is definitely more work, another insult to the patient, because their pain level is really going to spike a lot again, because at 6 weeks, they're starting to feel comfortable again with the fracture. And now you're disrupting everything. So ideally, you know, if I can get to a fracture in a couple of days, it's great, because those are much easier. The anatomy is not distorted. You have a lot of bleeding, but you don't have all that bursal inflammation and thickening that kind of distorts your the anatomy.
But I think, Anas, your question is based on the German system, kind of, because it does not depend here whether we're older or you're younger. Actually, when you're on call, so whatever, maybe you're 65 years old and you still have hot cases.
Yeah.
The system in Germany is a little bit different from the US. I guess the sooner the better.
Yes, thank you. As well, you think in 24 hours, in the first 24 hours.
Yeah.
You will do the surgery during your duty in the first 24 hours if the patient isn't direct after the injury.
Yeah.
Thank you. During the operation, how do you protect the axillary nerve? How do you protect the blood vessels and the brachial plexus? Joseph, do you have tricks?
I think that the same means the same. So I always tell my residents and fellows that it's not we're going to do this operation similar to how we do other operations. We're going to do it the same, which means, you know, delta pectoral approach, which I like because I use always the delta pectoral approach. I'm very comfortable with it. You know, I find my biceps. I make sure I identify my subscap, my conjoint up top on the conjoint. I will typically use either a blunt instrument or my finger and just sweep down. And as you sweep down between the conjoint and the subscap, even if they're a fracture and they have some, you know, bleeding and some callus formation, you should be able to separate that tissue nicely between the conjoint and the subscap and feel your axillary nerve right there. And just immediately that is your axillary artery. So typically once I've done that, I place a blunt Homan retractor on the glenoid neck. So on the glenoid neck between the subscap and the nerve is a blunt Homan retractor. That's keeping my neurovascular structures behind my retractor and my humeral head subscap in front of me. And sort of, that's, I think, a very safe way to stay away from the medial neurovascular structures, the muscutaneous nerve, the axillary nerve, the axillary artery. And then also try to avoid putting retractors on the humeral neck, because an inferior humeral neck retractor in that area can sometimes get the radial nerve as it's coming down and around the humeral shaft. So you got to be careful about that. And then up top, you're fairly safe. So, I mean, you know, up top, how you want to retract the deltoid depends on the fracture pattern and stability of the bone. And then again, on the lateral side, I'm clearing all the soft tissue between the acromial and humeral area and the deltoid and the humerus, feeling where the deltoid insertion is, and then putting a blunt retractor again between the humeral shaft and the deltoid. So now I have a nice open view of my proximal humerus. So I have really good access to everything. I see my pec, I see my biceps. I can identify, if need be, my lat. So I really have a great view at that point to start my fracture assessment, understanding three-dimensionally and fixation.
Yes, the second question, do you apply a bone graft? Which type of bone graft do you apply? Allograft, bone chips, or synthetic bone grafts, or fibular struts?
Yeah, I've done all those in my career. And I would say that early on in my career, I was using more of the calcium phosphate injectables. So, you know, DePuy-Synthes had the Norion. I used some of that, but it took a long time to set. So if I had really osteoporotic bone, I would consider using that. And then I kind of shifted to what I call dips and chips. So cancellous bone chips with some sort of synthetic matrix like DBX, putty, and mix it with some of the blood and get kind of a nice, it's almost like a meatball feel to it. And pack it into the head, because a lot of times you have this vacuous head that's empty and you have some comminution in that area of the junction of the surgical neck, and really pack it in there to give it some sort of extra support. Now, if I have a very unstable fracture pattern, particularly involving the medial calcar, I will not necessarily have to use a fibula. You can also use an ulna or a radius, and I will shape it. I know a lot of people place a long fibular strut down the canal. Not a great idea to put a long strut. I would make more of a trapezoid, with the apex of the trapezoid towards the tuberosity, so that it kicks the head into some valgus, and make that trapezoid kind of wedge into the medullary canal, the proximal humerus. So it only engages maybe a centimeter into the canal, but it's a stable fixation to keep the head from tilting constantly. So then when you place your screws, you have extra fixation into the cortical graft and near medial margin of the head. The nice thing about a short graft is, obviously, if you have to go back in for another reason, getting that out of the way is a lot less of a burden than if you have a long graft and now you're trying to cannulate a medullary canal that's full of another cortical graft.
Yeah, this is a nice trick to consider regarding the strut graft, because I think if the patient develop a vascular necrosis after 1 year, for example, or 2 years, and needs another revisional surgery, so it is easier to take this graft outside and to do the arthroplasty.
For
is
sure.
This, yeah. So now if we look up, at the x-rays and we have an old patient and we take in consideration that the risk of a vascular necrosis is high and the patient have an unfavorable prognostic factor. And we are considering treatment with arthroplasty. Which kind of arthroplasty you will choose in such cases? It's reliable to do a hemiarthroplasty or a reverse arthroplasty, according to your experience.
So I think in a younger patient, and this patient classifies as younger, if you are experienced with arthroplasty and anatomic arthroplasty, then I think it's reasonable to consider in this situation an anatomic hemiarthroplasty for a 49-year-old with good reconstruction of the tuberosities. And I think that particularly in this day and age, using a convertible stem may be advantageous in case we do fail. Then down the road, conversion to a reverse shoulder arthroplasty is a little bit simpler on them. I think that there are a lot of nuances to a hemiarthroplasty that, given the predominance of reverse shoulder arthroplasty in the market, that a lot of surgeons are not necessarily learning some of those nuances these days. And so executing a hemiarthroplasty in a fracture case is really a worst case scenario for them to execute an anatomic arthroplasty in that situation. So it's taking the most challenging patient and then making yourself do something that you're maybe not as familiar with, especially for, let's say, surgeons that are currently under the age of 40 or so, that trained more in the reverse era than they trained in, let's say, the anatomic arthroplasty era. But I do think someone with good bone quality, good tuberosities, where you're really concerned about the vascularity of the head, I think a hemiarthroplasty is still a good operation. But I think it's important that you make sure that either you're experienced at it or you ask for a colleague to assist you with doing that, executing that operation well.
Anas, I have here a question. Stepping backward, the decision you made was plate?
Yes.
Or IF?
Yeah.
But according to different algorithms and according to different classifications, the best decision for this patient with 49 years old is the hemiarthroplasty, the anatomical hemiarthroplasty. Yet my question is, why did you give the patient the chance for a plate?
Yeah, I told the communication and counseling the patient is one of the most important thing to take the decision in such cases. You have to be honest with your patient. You have to tell your patient about the risk of a vascular necrosis. And the patient have to decide. Some patient, you tell the patient there is a high risk for a vascular necrosis and complication if you decide for ORF, and let the patient choose their therapy options. The patient decided to have to retain her shoulder joint. She didn't want to have an arthroplasty. She came directly after the trauma incident, and we operated the patient after 6 hours. So I think I have done everything but to reduce the risk of necrosis. Yet the risk is there.
You have like 2 years ahead where the avascular necrosis can hit the patient, and then you have to switch your decision to a hemiarthroplasty. And here it's not only implanting the prosthesis, but also removing the plate and screws. So the infection danger is much more high.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's some recent studies that showed, although there is a risk for humeral head necrosis after such an injury, the patients are really happy.
Mm-hmm.
Although they have a necrosis. So you may do if the screws come outside the cortex involving the joints, so you can remove these screws, or you can remove this hardware, and the patient are happy with the results. Also they develop a humeral head necrosis. What do you think, Joseph, about this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, in your situation, I think that if you can get an anatomic reconstruction, AVN in the shoulder is not as symptomatic as AVN in the hip or knee. So they may actually have a decent outcome, even if they develop AVN, and in a delayed fashion, 7, 8, 9 years later, you can consider either an anatomic arthroplasty or an RSA in that patient. So it's something that I have experience with. You know, it's still a doable revision. Now, you know, is one surgery better than two? Sure. But I think it's always complicated. And I think we also have to be honest with ourselves. You know, somebody that's doing shoulder may have a lot more experience with excellent ORIFs than they have with, let's say, anatomic arthroplasty or reverses. And in their hands, they can get a much better result than, say, another surgeon who does only arthroplasty and has not done that many ORIFs. So I think, you know, it's not just the patient disease, it's also the surgeon factor that plays a bit of a role here that sometimes gets overlooked.
So you think a perfect anatomical reduction and experience of the orthopedic surgeon also play a role?
Important role.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And I think that's where we have to be honest with ourselves when we look ourselves in the mirror and say, am I the best person for this operation? And in my hands, is this an executable operation?
Yes. So I think that reverse shoulder arthroplasty is an option also for these patients, because some studies are also showed that there is that the tubercles will not heal, and there's a risk of pseudo paralysis after hemiarthroplasty. So if we are opting for reverse arthroplasty to treat humeral head fractures, particularly in these trauma patients, how do you approach these patients? Is this different from arthroplasty in a patient with osteoarthritis?
Yes, it is. It is different. I think that there are landmarks that are disrupted. I think that the glenoid exposure is much easier. For example, let's say this patient was a bit older, and you were going to do a reverse. Once you were able to extract the head, you have a wide open view of the glenoid. You need to tag your tuberosities. So, you know, with reverse, you should also be doing tuberosity reconstruction. A lot of times, even in this patient, the medial calcar is intact. So, you know, executing the glenoid side of putting a base plate in and using whatever glenosphere you like to use is fairly straightforward in these cases, because you have wide exposure. And then essentially for me, the medial aspect of the stem is going to lay on the calcar region. So in a person with good bone quality like this person, potentially a press fit stem and then placement. And a lot of times, again, placement here of a standard sized liner for the stem, a polyethylene liner, is typical, and they then have their tuberosities with these stem systems reconstructed to the stem and to each other, and they're very stable. So the concern about instability that sometimes we have with the reverse, in my experience, is less so with fractures, it does give more predictable. So, you know, a lot of people will say that my best anatomic hemiarthroplasty fracture is better than my best reverse. That might be true, but your likelihood of hitting a home run with an anatomic, I think, is not that high. And sometimes a double is even harder with an anatomic. Whereas with the reverse, you can predictably hit a double, hitting a home run. Again, in American terms here, you know, we could use different analogies, but, you know, is harder with a reverse, but at times doable. So I think it's dealer's choice. Again, if it's 49-year-old patient, I think some people would do a reverse. I don't necessarily think that's not good practice. I just think that, again, it depends on what's going to work best in your hands, and the patient understanding the pros and cons of each decision in this situation.
Yes, here you see the community. Oh. They answered this question. They, a lot, 27% will choose hemiarthroplasty, and 20% will choose reverse shoulder arthroplasty in such case.
Yeah, it's controversial. You know, you see 40% would do an RAF of some sort or not an arthroplasty. Yeah. And then, yes, you know, then you get 20 and 25% with arthroplasty. I'm not sure who's doing the total shoulder, but that's interesting.
Yeah. So, Atala, do you consider
two weeks ago, I had the same case, and the patient was, 41 years old, younger than your patient.
Yes.
And it was very controversial in our clinic whether we go for the prosthesis or we go for the plate.
Yeah.
I was for the plate. I wanted just to give the chance to the patient with a plate and to see what's going to happen. And I opened the whole cards in front of the patient and I told her about everything. And she decided also for the plate. Concerning prosthesis, I would go actually for the hemiarthroplasty in this age, when the patient's like 40, is 41, 49. So if you're talking about prosthesis, I would go for the anatomical hemiarthroplasty. But I would go for prosthesis that I can convert to an inverse prosthesis when complications from the hemiarthroplasty, the anatomical hemiarthroplasty, are on board. So actually you can have the stem inside, and you just, whether anatomical or inverse, you will see in the upcoming years.
So the next question, I am considering to do a reverse arthroplasty in such a case. My question will be how to reduce the risk of dislocation after reverse arthroplasty. Joseph, this is a trauma situation and not osteoarthritis. How do you deal with lateralization of the glenoid component? How to deal with inclination and retroversion? Do you do an extensive capsular release in a such case? Do you use, for example, bio RSA using a bone graft or metal augmentation of the base plate fixation?
Yeah, so I think in a typical fracture situation, fresh fracture, if you decide to go down the reverse shoulder arthroplasty route, for me, I don't worry as much about instability as I would worry if it was a cuff tear arthropathy patient who has proximal humeral migration that's statically migrated and femoralization of the humeral head and astabilization of the acromion. Those are my patients that I worry more about instability. In this situation, generally, you don't have much deformity. So you're not dealing with a with a deformed glenoid, you're not dealing with loss of the cuff per se. You're going to reconstruct the tuberosities for stability. So, you know, getting your sizing right can be a little challenging because they have some swelling of the soft tissues at this point. And so I think this is where, you know, being mentored and having some experience helps, because even though you're worried that it's going to be too tight or too loose, I think if you're using a system and using it, you know, consistently for other patients, you get very comfortable with the sizes that make sense for that patient. So, for example, if I'm dealing with a thinner, smaller individual with a lower BMI versus a larger individual, I'm going to, in my system, use a smaller glenosphere with less lateralization. I don't do bi-RSAs. I use a more metal-based lateralization system in the implant that I use. So I would use a fairly straightforward size that I would use in that sized patient if they didn't have a fracture, because once their swelling comes down and their tuberosities heal, they will act very much like an arthroplasty that was done for arthritis. An arthroplasty and reverse arthroplasty done for arthritis behaves very differently than a reverse arthroplasty done for cuff tear arthropathy as far as the risk profile. So do I do a full release? Yes, I still do a full release circumferentially to capsule. I will, my personal preference is, you know, in a patient like this, you're going to have all the cartilage in the glenoid. So you got to ubernate all the cartilage off so you can see where the actual glenoid bone is to place your pin where you want to place it. And again, every system is a little bit nuanced in how you want to do it, but I tend to, you know, place my pin fairly zero as far as antiversion, retroversion, maybe 5 degrees of retroversion, but not more. 5 to 10 is acceptable. And then I will slightly inferiorly inferior inclination. So I think in the past we used to do more inferior inclination. I still do some inferior inclination. I think it does help with improving the moment arm around the soft tissues for range of motion, but not excessively. So maybe 5 degrees or so. But you know, the exposure on the glenoid side, like I said, once you have the head out of the way, it's a very generous head cut. So you have great exposure on that side. I think the I would have fluoro available, because I do like to see where my medial calcar of my stem is relative to my my humeral shaft that's fractured, to make sure it's looking like it should look when I do a standard RSA. But I will tell you, it's comforting to know most of these fractures, if you use the sort of standard sizes, meaning non-augmented liners, non-augmented big heads, the patients are going to do fine. You're going to kind of trust yourself after doing this a while and reconstruct it and repair your tuberosities. And it's going to be very stable. You know, giving it some time for the tuberosities to heal to the stem is important for a couple weeks, and then starting them in motion to get the range of motion back. I think they still always have more difficulty with internal rotation than they would have had with an anatomic or their native joint.
Do you consider the refixation of the tubercula by reverse arthroplasty?
Do I do it?
Yeah, that was my next question.
Yeah, so when I'm doing a reverse shoulder, I do fix the tuberosities to the stem. Yes.
Okay.
And I think they, you know, as been shown in studies, they do have better outcomes. They still can get good outcomes if the tuberosity is not fixed well, but I think it's much better to fix the tuberosities well.
Yes.
Because I think they will have more stability and they will have better external rotation and forward elevation strength.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Some people are considering resection of the tubercles, but I
think that is dangerous. I think it's potentially obviously faster, but yes. I think the chance of instability increases significantly, especially when you lose your greater tuberosity.
Yes, it's right. I think it's very important to refix the tuberosity because of the range of motion, the external rotation, and also to protect the patient from hematoma also, the soft tissue management. How do you fix your shaft? Do you use cemented shaft or stems or press fit?
So in most cases, they're older patients. So I would cement the stem distally. So I will cement the stem distally, and people have talked about putting cement distally and then putting some of your cancellous bone from your resected head into the proximal portion to bone graft the proximal portion to get bone growth between the proximal humeral shaft and tuberosities to your stem. So, but I would say in my patient population is predominantly older, I am cementing the stem distally because a lot of times these patients have poor cortical bone and I don't want to go line to line and try to press fit.
Yes.
So in our clinic, we're just making it according to age. Patients over 80 got cement. Patients below 80, they will not be cemented. It does not have any evidence-based. It's not evidence-based, but it's just like a tradition in our clinic. Okay. I guess it's not that it's not that bad too.
They are also some companies. They provide cemented stems, and some surgeons they do it uncemented off-label use, for example.
Yeah.
But I do the same as Joseph.
You applied distally.
Distally and proximally, yeah. I will add bone graft to enhance the healing of the tuberculum.
Do you guys consider the humeral inclination of 135 degrees by the reversed prothesis?
I do, yes.
Okay.
Yes, and I do some inclination, inferior inclination of the...
On the glenoid.
Of the glenoid.
Yeah, okay.
So after doing the operations, what is your post-operative protocols for patients undergoing open reduction and internal fixation of the humeral head? Is it different from arthroplasty group or also the conservative treatment option? How do you manage these patients post-operatively?
So if it's an ORIF, I want to walk out of that room with a very stable construct. If it's very tenuous, then I probably did the wrong operation or I didn't execute it right. So if it's very stable, then I typically have them in the sling until their first postoperative visit, which is usually around 7 to 10 days. And then I have them start coming out of the sling, using the arm for waist level activity and starting range of motion exercise with a therapist, typically one day a week. And then I'll see him again 2 weeks after that, get another x-ray, see how things are, and then gauge where they are in their rehab. For me, that's very similar to how I manage my RSA for fracture, my reverse for fracture. My anatomic for fracture, I'm going to hold them longer because I'm more concerned about their tuberosity healing. So I'm probably going to keep them in a sling. In my past experience, typically 3 to 4 weeks. Make sure I get some early callus formation before I start moving my hemiarthroplasties. This looks excellent, by the way.
Yeah, thank you so much. And for conservative therapy, if you are doing conservative therapy for proximal humeral fracture, how is your post-operative protocol? How do you manage these patients? Do you do a control x-ray? At which time? How do you approach these patients with physiotherapy after such fractures?
Depending on the fracture pattern, I'm actually pretty meticulous on how often I see them. I'll often see them if they just came in the first week. I'll see them weekly for about 4 weeks to make sure the fracture does not shift in alignment. Because if it shifts in alignment, then it may affect their overall outcome, and they need to know that. Because I have seen probably maybe 15% of fractures over the years that shift acutely in the first 2 to 3 weeks, and it changes your management and also the algorithm for potential outcomes. And you need to have that conversation with them. Typically, it's anywhere between 4 to 6 weeks for me in a sling. I believe patients understand stop and go. They don't understand in between. So you start telling them to do pendulums and scapular retraction exercise, except they get confused. Yeah. They can use their arm fully. And then after that, they're doing therapy. And I tell them up front, even with non-operative management, listen to me carefully, I say to them, It's going to take you 5 months to feel that you've recovered 80%, a year to fully plateau. And there still will be limitations, but it takes a long time. Because sometimes people will see an innocuous tuberosity fracture and tell the patient, you'll be great in 6 weeks. No, tuberosity fracture will be painful. They will get stiff. They will take 5 months to be 80%. These are sometimes like, you know, your athletes who dive and get a slight tuberosity fracture and they think it's going to be nothing. No, it's a big deal. That tuberosity does not like to be messed with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think you just said you weekly. You mean weekly radiographic examinations, or yeah, you mean just visiting you in the clinic?
You know, first of all, like we said at the beginning, this is a new experience for these patients. Oftentimes, the first time they come in, there's heads swirling. They've been told no surgery, surgery, no surgery, surgery. Now you decided no surgery, so now they're developing bad ecchymosis, bruising, swelling. They come back in, they say, what's going on with my forearm? It's the size of an eggplant now. It looks like purple. Is something wrong with my elbow? No, that's the tracking of the blood. So a lot of things that they gain from each visit, that even though they're brief visits, they're really helpful visits for them. I find them very educational for the patient. And personally, from my style, I prefer over-educating them than to sort of have them disappear for 3 to 4 weeks, potentially have issues that they weren't aware of, under-educate them, and then they become dissatisfied with the care that I provided them.
Actually, my clinic, we let the patients visit us every 3 to 4 days for the first 2 weeks. And starting from the third week, we let them visit us weekly till the end of the 6 weeks.
Yeah.
I think it's a little bit meticulous, but I think it's not that bad. This often visit.
So
just going to quickly comment, guys, we're at pretty far into it. We should try to wrap it up at about 5 minutes just because it's been fantastic, excellent, but I think we should try to bring it to an end just so it doesn't go too long and you guys can get on with your lives.
Yeah, I would.
Thank you.
So, I think in summary, such cases is a complex cases. The development of a new classification system and algorithm to manage these patients is important. I think we have to talk honestly with our patients about the risk of necrosis and the failure of the open reduction and fixation. I think also that the patient age, comorbidity, past medical history, smoking, diabetes, alcohol, I think these are very relevant factors to guide us in the taking the decision. Most importantly is the morphology of the fracture. I deal with patients with a split fracture of the hips. I think it is more likely that they will develop a necrosis of the humeral head. Also, if the medial hinge is not intact, various deformity of the head, it will alarm me to go more ahead and to take the decision to do an arthroplasty. So I'm now talking about the operative management of these type of fractures with internal fixation and open reduction and internal fixation. I typically use the deltopectoral approach as Dr. Abboud also mentioned previously. So I reduced the fracture using suture wires, fiber wires, and K wires as a joystick. I protected the neurovascular bundle after I reached the subscapular and tendon and the conjoint tendon. Then I fixed the fracture temporarily with K wires. I used bone chips as an allogenic bone grafts. Then I fixed the fracture with this plate. I tried to support the medial calcar with two screws. Intraoperatively, I checked many times with X-rays that an optimal position of the fracture and the screws. I fixed also the infraspinatus, supraspinatus, and subscapular tendon with fiber wire screws through the plates. So, Abdallah, what do you think about the
difficult... I just have a question. How did you address the head? There was a fragment, a big fragment of the head. How did you address it to approach the rest of the humerus with a KY?
Yes. I dissected through the deltopectoral approach, and then I found the intertubercular sulcus, the biceps tendon, then coracoid process and conjoint tendon. Then I reached through the subscapula tendon. I used attractors to protect the neurovascular bundle medially. And with finger, I mobilized the head fragment and reduced it. Then I
without opening the capsule of the joint, without any arthrotomy.
No, because the lesser tubercle was fractured, and you can elevate the subscapular tendon a little bit, and you will enter the joint. I have seen
Through the fracture.
Yeah, through the fracture. The fracture. Then I fixed these fragments together with K-wires.
Okay.
Yeah,
I
fix the fractures every time before I use my plate, because there's a tendency to have a various malposition of the head if you reduce the fracture over the plate. In some fracture patterns, I use the plate to help me
to reduce the fracture.
Reduce the fractures. But in this case, yeah. I didn't use the plate as an aid for reposition.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now I will be just a little bit mean. Sorry?
I was just wondering how far after surgery is this x-ray? Because it looks like there's a fair amount of healing that's happened.
Well, when was the x-ray?
The x-ray was directly post-operative.
Right.
Two days after the operation. Yes. I don't have any recent x-rays, unfortunately, to show the results. Yes. So, Abdallah, what do you consider?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe the plate should have been a little bit distal. So the Parker screws would come to the right place. I don't know. Maybe it's just
these two screws are the calcar screws which support the medial column, but I tried to move the plate proximally, but this is the oval hole of this screw. It was at the end. I didn't I couldn't do this. I accepted best results. Sometimes it's difficult
So actually you didn't put any calcar screws in over the plate or through the plate.
These two screws were very
close to the calcar region, but the calcar screws are not placed.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. No, this is the only comment. Otherwise it's best outcome for the patient, I mean, with plate and screws.
Yes.
I wish I'd have done the same.
So, Joseph, what are your comments? How What is your comment on this X-rays? How can I get better results?
I mean, I think you, for the fracture that you had, this is a fantastic reconstruction of the head and tuberosities. I think that teaching point just for the audience is, yes, if you can put those calcar screws in, that gives more support potentially for collapse. But, you know, you have great distal fixation, good proximal fixation without overpenetration of the screws medially, so decrease the risk of, if there is AVN and collapse, the screws destroying the glenoid. You can see that the dynamically the head's well centered on the glenoid fossa on the scapular Y view. The axillary nerve, at least based on the Shenton's line, may have a little bit of attenuation because of the head's dropped a little bit, but that's probably a slight neuropraxia that usually resolves pretty quickly. It's not significantly decreased as far as lower the head there. So I think you did a great job. You know, cosmetically, the plate looks great. It's well centered on the shaft, which is always nice for your X-ray as well.
Thank you so much. So can you add a summary or conclusion? How do you deal with these fractures?
I mean, I think this is a great webinar that you've led on us, and it's been great doing it with you and Abdullah as far as, you know, the many nuanced tricks of management of proximal humerus fractures in a variety of situations. This was a very bad case in a young patient, but these are cases that come in all the time for general orthopedics, traumatologists, shoulder surgeons, upper extremity surgeons, sports surgeons. So I think that this has a wide array of appeal for the audience as far as understanding the nuances of treatment, both non-operative and operative, and then how to go through, if you do decide on operative management, how to go through the actual surgery, and then the rehab process and potential outcomes. So excellent case. I really enjoyed the discussion and getting to know both of you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Joseph Abdullah.
This is the best what the patient can have on, and I think I would have done the same plate, and you've done it great.
Thank you so much. So I'm so happy to have you today, and I am I learned a lot from you. Thank you for sharing your experience. And I hope I can meet you all, also personally in the next conferences or courses you are providing.
Me too.
Thank you so much. Okay.